accident. It's quite fun to see somebody make fun of the term evangelist, and now imagine having a name like Christian and evangelist as your job title. The amount of like spam mail I got from Bible study groups was quite amazing. They're like, yeah, you should come and feed on a Bible study group and do stuff with us. And I'm like, I could, but you catch fire if I do. So it's probably not a good idea, but yeah, well, if they pay, I mean, who cares? Now, let's see if that crashes. So far, so good. Do a recording in case everything crashes. So normally I'm giving 20 to 30 minute talks, and when I came here, he's like, yeah, well, we have to spend money on you and tickets and stuff, so we make sure we get as much as we get out of you. So I have this long, long keynote thing now and a JavaScript thing. If you want to interrupt, you're a terrible person. But if you want to know more, I'll be here all day as well. And I do need my voice tomorrow as well, because I'm flying to New York, but it's going to be okay so far. I expected it to be much colder, actually. I was in Sydney last week, and I live in London. So this is the same weather as London, so I'm happy about this, because I was expecting reindeer and polar bears in the street and stuff like that. But no, it didn't happen. So I always find it funny when I talk to marketing people about what I do, and they're like, yeah, you're a rock star developer, and there's nothing I hate more than this term, because it's just like, you know, if somebody calls you a rock star developer, just trash a cubicle in the office, you know, smash some things, they're like, you wanted a rock star, didn't you? And then they put you in venues like this, and you're like, okay, damn it, you know, might be that it's happening. They also told me not to go outside that line, because the camera doesn't get me, so if I want to be like, you know, and I can mess with people online. Are we streaming?
No.
Good, I can say things I shouldn't. I'm Chris Heilman. I've been web developing for a long, long time, 1997 or something like that. And I worked on Yahoo stuff, on Yahoo Maps, Yahoo Answers. I did Visit Britain, McDonald's Code.UK, HP's website for Europe. And then I started at Mozilla and was part of the Firefox team there and part of Firefox OS. And build an operating system on HTML5. And then when Microsoft said, like, hey, we're not evil anymore, do you want to talk to open source developers for us? And I'm like, yeah, let's see how that works out. And it worked out really well so far. So I'm really excited to be in the place where a lot of bad things happened in the past and good things are happening now. Because sadly enough, when I compared, especially on the mobile market, when I compared the web to native environments, a lot of the web looks a bit like this. This is not my flat. This is a picture I found on the internet. I don't have that. It's too big for a flat in London, actually. That's the main point. But we have quite a mess out there. And the problem is that we always had gaps in technology on the web. We always knew about the gaps that we needed to work around. When I started as a web developer, my main skill was how do different browsers mess up and how to work around that problem. This was the main skill to have. And that's kind of depressing because you're basically the garbage collector of the internet somehow. But this was the browsers that we had, like Netscape 4, Internet Explorer 4, Internet Explorer 5, 501 Mac, then Conqueror came around, Opera came around, and all of these became weirder and weirder, and then we started standardizing them to have a predictable way of working. But the gaps still stayed, and a few of these things that you probably never heard of, we really had to find workarounds for. One of them was this. So we had a very sensible markup. So this is a UL with ID nav, but nowadays we have a nav element as well. It gives you a bit more accessibility about that. And then we had list items in there with links, and that gave you the links there. The only problem is Internet Explorer 6 and 7 made this out of that, because obviously the white space in between the closing LI and the opening LI should be something that's rendered. Should not at all. It's like according to the HTML specs, white space in between elements should be disregarded. But Internet Explorer 6 and 7 made this out of it. So we've had to find a way to make that work. So what we did is, we did this terrible thing where we just didn't close the... We took out the white space and opened the LI element and closed the element on the next line. That was one way of making that work, but it still looks awful. Then we had like comments inside that one. That was another way of doing that. And it's just kind of, the idea of HTML is that it describes the content. This is what HTML does. HTML is not programming. Whenever people tell you I'm an HTML programmer, that was some marketing person coming up with that term. HTML is markup. It describes what something is supposed to do. And the real code of the browser or your own JavaScript then turns it into something that is interactive. HTML in itself just describes what the content is. In essence, it could be read by a user, or it can be read by a developer, or read by a browser. And then the other way of doing it was just closing the LI and opening it, the LI directly again, and just indenting the links. All of these things worked, but all of these things felt kind of dirty. We didn't want to have to do that. And fixes were plentiful. When we started having CSS, when HTML was not the thing that we only could do, we had other fixes. We had, for example, a height of 1 pixel on Internet Explorer 6 and 7, also got rid of those white spaces. That became problematic when Opera did the right thing and rendered them as 1 pixel high. So then we had to find out, like, okay, how do we only get Internet Explorer to do that and not Opera and Netscape 5 as well and Netscape 6, who did that properly? That's why we had conditional comments. So if it's less than Internet Explorer 7, then put that whole style element in there. And you can see that that doesn't scale. That is like, when you have to do that for every single browser that comes out and fix the things for every browser, you're writing for browsers, not for end users. And you're writing for a certain amount in time, a certain period in time as well, rather than just for a for the internet for the future. The idea of the internet is like, it's backwards compatible. So what I've written in 1996 can still be rendered in websites nowadays. The other day, Apple's first website came out again, and Microsoft's first website got found again, and twice people just put that in a browser, and the browser said, okay, I'm gonna show that to you. And that's the great thing, and we shouldn't build things that need a certain browser because we don't know what's coming next. I mean, IoT is coming, like people put their internet on their fridge, their car, their cat, their children, whatever comes in the way, somebody installs something on it, like we did with Linux years ago. And some of them were very specific to browser issues, some of those fixes that we had. So for example, in IE, we had this wonderful star hack in CSS. So anything followed by a star, Internet Explorer would show, all the others realized this is broken CSS, so we're gonna skip that line and go to the next one. So that way we put a lot of fixes into our CSS that were only available for Internet Explorer 7. And this stuff is still online, and it's kind of embarrassing by now because there's no users on Internet Explorer 7 any longer. Or not in most countries, not in most outside of internet cafes, somewhere in the rural India or Bangladesh. And then we had, for example, display inline block in IE was fixed, so it stayed as inline block, and all the others would override it as block. So Internet Explorer was the only one to not reassign that, so we needed to know what browsers do wrong to write code, and that's just not a good way of working. And all of these solutions, they were there, but they kind of felt bad. We just basically had to patch and fix and know what's wrong, and when new developers came in and looked at that and that didn't know about these hacks, they're like, what is that? Can I delete this? And you're like, no, don't touch it. It's like, it's not working. I mean, I worked for a large corporation, for example, where we had a server where all the APIs went through. Magical black box that if the machine died, the company would not have had any APIs at all. We tried to clone the machine, the clone didn't work. So that kind of knowledge is the problem in IT. There are a lot of people save their jobs by being the only one of being able to fix it. And it always feels you like, okay, I did this, I'm not proud of it, but my job is safe because I'm the one who knows about it. But I don't want to fix that for the next 30 years. I want to free myself from that as well. So the light has broken, but I still work. It's not the thing that you want to be in. So what can we do about these problems that browsers have? Like, should we write extra markup to work around the issues with the parser, like the comments or the lines or the extra closing and closing the next line? That doesn't feel right. Should we rely on hacks that exploit known problems in the CSS parser of the offending browser? That was the star hack, for example. That was a mistake in the CSS engine. And we could not even patch that in Internet Explorer 7 or Microsoft back then, because I didn't have anything to do with them. I was really evil, Netscape guy. And we couldn't fix the CSS engine because we would break people's websites. And that carried on to today. We cannot, every time you rely on a hack like that, we cannot fix the browser. And that's not the way we want to work. Should we rely on known bugs in the CSS parser, like the inline block not being overwritten by block any longer? Don't think so either. It's a very bad idea. Or should we create a dedicated style sheet with all the quirks in them, one for each offending browser? And you see that, IE6.css, IE7.css, Opera.css. It doesn't scale again, because there's 167 different browsers out there. And when I worked with a large company that does things about books and faces, they tried to detect what browser was in use, and they found like over 20,000 user agent strings. So you cannot know which browser is out there. So all these fixes seem to be like, doesn't really do the job. You could find a solution and ensure that only the problematic browsers get it, which is kind of better. That's where conditional comments were actually quite fun. Conditional comments meant that only the Internet Explorer that you defined would get that. For all the other browsers, it was just an HTML comment. Of course, it was mixing behavior and it was mixing presentation and markup, which is not a good idea, but it was not that bad. There was worse things to do than just detect that one and let the browser decide what it is. There were also inline conditional style sheets in CSS that nobody ever used except for a few people for clever hacks. And it's quite funny that no one ever did, because actually nowadays we do something similar with media queries and with all kind of like font faces as well. So how should we sort of stop trying to solve the problem of browser creators and feedback issues so that browsers can improve? And that's the perfect situation. As developers of browsers, we want to give you the best browsers out there. As web developers, we want to have good browsers. The only problem is, like, if you fix what is broken in the browser using CSS, JavaScript, client-side detection, server-side detection, all kind of things, browsers never can get better. And the feedback mechanism nowadays is good. But back then, of course, the problem is we didn't have any feedback channels. So developers, browser makers were basically these people that work in the dark and didn't get fed until a new browser comes out. And we didn't have any chance to tell them what's going on. We were just complaining. Whereas like browser makers were already surfing the web and were looking around for people's blog posts, including mine, where I fixed things in the browser and said, like, oh, here's a bug in that browser that we feedback to quirksmode.org, which was a big website back then about browser issues. And then they fixed it from there. But what we needed more was a channel where people can communicate directly. So instead of having a browser as this unknown thing that we have to work with, it should be a symbiosis between developers and browser makers, because we're relying on each other, really. So instead of having feedback channels, we did the next best thing. We wrote abstraction libraries to fix browser issues for us. And that was, of course, the jQuery's. That was like all kind of bootstrap, these kind of things that made like, okay, just use this and don't worry about the browser. We solve every problem on the browser for you, which is quite a burden if you think about it, because you have now to test in every browser and people rely on your library to fix every browser issue out there. So instead of just concentrating on writing a library to give people convenience methods and like make it easier for them to write a lot of code in a short amount of time, you become their dependency to actually build things for them. So there was no waiting for browsers. Let's innovate and build the things we want. And that's a big thing for developers, that we keep getting told that browsers innovate not fast enough. We want to have the new cool things now. And I can do it in JavaScript. How come you cannot do it in the browser? Not understanding that a browser is a massive piece of software, and with lots of moving parts and lots of dependencies on other people as well. Like 40%, 60% of what we do in browsers is not breaking the web and finding really broken things on the web and having to put them inside our browsers to basically be backwards compatible. Browsers will catch up and we can remove our abstractions. That's always the thing when people say like, oh, we only use jQuery until browsers don't suck any longer. And sadly enough, this never happened, because you fixed all these problems. There was no incentive for browser makers to fix things when people used libraries anyways, because it's no fun to write something for a 15-year-old browser when you have a new browser coming out that you should concentrate on. We are also engineers. Like the browser makers are groups of engineers. Some of us have social lives, not too many, but we want to get out and we want to do other things as well. So we have to concentrate on the thing that gives us the most outcome for what we put in. So we want to make sure that the things that we fix really are still a problem. But if you used libraries for that, it wasn't a problem. It didn't show up. It didn't get reported. It didn't even show up in our rendering that it was wrong, because the libraries fixed it. Except we never do move out of these libraries. We never delete these old libraries and the helper tools. The amount of developers that in the last 5 years learned jQuery instead of JavaScript, and was the first thing that they came with. And they're like, well, I mean, I interviewed people for Mozilla, I interviewed people for Yahoo, and they came in and said like, you know, 17-year-old kids in the Silicon Valley like, oh, I only work in that environment with that editor, and yeah, I'm not going to write vanilla JavaScript because that's stupid. And you're like, well, I asked you to be a JavaScript developer on the Firefox engine, so did you really think we write a browser in jQuery? Because we don't. It's like JavaScript itself, the language. You should know that stuff as well. But it's so much easier to release a lot of stuff, and I think it's kind of depressing as well, because you never get the recognition that you expect. You know, it's like taking a painting and then filling in the colors and then going to somebody, look, I stayed in the lines, well done. But painting the picture yourself might be less quality, but it's much more rewarding for yourself because you did the thing. You made it. And there's research in that Paul Arielli did some really good talk on where recognition and a recognition by our peers is much more important than remuneration and money for it. They did this test where they asked people, okay, we give you a menial task and we give you $1 to do it. And then when you do it the second time, we give you 90 cents to do it. And the third time, we give you 80 cents and so on and so forth. And they asked people, where they tested how long it took people to stop doing the task. And the interesting bits were, the first one was they asked people to build Lego Bionicles, like put Lego things together. And that test was kind of skewed because there's an emotional aspect to it. There's two kind of people. There's people who like Lego, and there's soulless freaks who shouldn't be in this planet. The second task, then they took the emotional thing out. They took a piece of paper and asked people to count the letters, like how many A's are in this page and these kind of things. So then they had three scenarios. The first one, they got the paper back, and the person looked at it, like nodded, and put it on a pile. And that one went up to like 70, 60 cent. The second one was the person would take the paper, not look at it, and just put it next to them. And the third one was people would take the paper and shred it without looking at it. Of course, the second and the third scenario was the one where the drop-off was at 90%. Like, people like, yeah, okay, this is not worth my time. Although it's a dollar. Funnily enough, nobody cheated. Nobody even said, like, well, if you're not going to look at it, I'll just keep giving you papers. That's fine, you know? Nobody cheated because even that was not worth our time. So as humans, we want to be recognized. And I think when we rely too much on third-party solutions and we get praised for them, it's very weird for us. It's called this imposter syndrome. When your product manager comes up to you or introduces you in a meeting, oh yeah, it's one of our programmers, he's absolutely amazing, I don't know how these guys do it. And you just basically put three libraries together and had no idea how these things work. So you feel like, okay, you get built up, and at the same time, you know you're a fraud. And that's a massive thing that's going on in our community, because we rely too much on things that are magical and fix things for us. So at these events, like not necessarily this one, but I go to a lot of conferences that are, yeah, like these inspiring ones, like JSConf and SmashingConf. We talk about these amazing solutions. They notice, like, here's the build script to end all build scripts. Use Gulp, Grunt, Barp, Fart, whatever they're called nowadays. Like, here's the 10,000 things to do that makes your job so much easier. And they're all kind of missing the point, because they're not being in use. They're not only built for events to show off to each other. You don't see them much in production. Funnily enough, a lot of them come actually with the sign saying, like, don't use in productions. You're like, what do I use it for then? You know, what's that for? Just for a slide deck right now? Just to win hacker news for the day? And that is, to me, also a sign that we our communication with our higher ups are broken. Like, instead of like getting a recognition from our jobs, from the people who pay our money, we have to find recognition in the community because we feel unhappy otherwise. A lot is not working the way it should on the web. And I've seen websites that look similar like that. And you're like, yeah, somewhere there's a problem there. This is the average time a website needs nowadays to fully load. And if you thought that was awkward, imagine being on a mobile phone where you pay per minute. I hate doing this on stage, but like it brings to, if I just told you 15 seconds is what pages load, you're like, yeah, whatever. But I'm like, what is he doing? Is his computer broken? What's going on here? And it's the same when you go on a mobile device. You all of a sudden you're like five screens, and like everything is black, black. Damn phone, you know, like it's the website. It's not the phone at all. It's a pretty terrible state of the web if you think about it. We got a median page is 5.5 seconds to load and renders in over 15 seconds. research, like all the clever UX research, says like everything more than 3 seconds, people just don't care. Instead, they just do other things, go to your competitors and give them millions of dollars, and you're gonna die in a ditch if you don't do it that way. It's 2 megabyte in size and contains 170 resources. It's like we didn't have any performance talks ever in the last 10 years. You know, it's like we shave 50 milliseconds of our JavaScript by minifying it, or we tell you to not use semicolons because that means you can save so much more characters. And then people put like 5 megabyte pictures in there or bitmap files because obviously copying and pasting from Word onto the web is what it should be like. Most sites fail to take advantage of core image optimization techniques. Just the idea that a PNG with 24-bit and alpha channel should not be a photo, but a JPEG is probably the better way of doing that, or a GIF is not something that a photo should be done as. But yeah, I mean, this is gone. I mean, the amount of stuff. When you look at Imgur, for example, the amount of traffic that every single day we show each other animated GIFs coming from videos. And now all these sites, to save traffic, they turn these GIFs into videos again. You're like, what? You know what happened there? Like, why did we do this? Why do we just send things on the web because we're on a fast connection and we don't understand the problems of our end users? But I think that's in the second talk today. It's not uncommon. The iPad Pro website, when that came out by a certain company in California, it said like it's huge in almost every way. It talked about the design, but I actually found that the website is huge in every way because it was 34 megabyte and it loaded in 1.3 minute on my 1 gigabit connection in Sweden. And at home in London, I probably would like still wait for the thing to load. And why? You know, this could be a video. You know, this could probably be better as a video instead of an interactive website that's 34 megabyte. But I mean, it's all about the design, it's all about the thing. And I think Apple just can assume that their users are on fast connections because they cater to the high-end market. When I worked with the police in England, I learned that iPhones are stolen about 5 times more than Android phones. Because having an iPhone brings you into a different social class. It's like, it's the bling thing, you know, about it. And it just cracks me up because it's software and hardware. Jesus, people, get over yourself. The iPad Pro website before that as well was similar. It was like 8.3 meg on the lower resolution and finished in 55 seconds and 23 second loading time. So what can we do about this? What we realize this is broken, and there has to be a reason why that's broken, because we're not stupid. And Apple's developers are amazing. They're incredibly good guys. They know how to build a website that's beautiful. They know how to make it accessible. They make it work across all browsers as well. But for some reason, 34 megabyte end up somewhere on the web. And it's always about timing. It's always about the press release is going out, make this thing live. Don't worry about it, we fix it later. We fix it later is the biggest lie on this planet. It's just followed by, I read the terms and conditions. So whenever somebody tells you like, do this now and we fix it later, just tell them, no, it's gonna happen. It's not gonna go. And maybe it's a pride thing. I mean, if I always compared it with plumbers. Say you have a problem with your plumbing in your house and you call a plumber and you fix it. If you treat them like a web developer, it would probably be like, well, you obviously know your stuff. Here's a few old rusty pipes. Can you use those? Because I don't wanna pay for that new stuff. And don't use that tool, use that little spanner that I have, and we fix it together and make it cheaper. How about that? And then the plumber basically says, like, how about short word, and I'm going home. Whereas we like, yeah, okay, we do it again, and we make it again. Maybe it's just standing up for ourselves and saying, like, you know what? It's going to be on me afterwards. And if I spend now an extra week making the thing right, we don't have to maintain it terribly in the next 5 years. Or somebody else who's coming after me can read the stuff that I've done. Give me some time to document it. Or just pretend that it was a technical problem and do the documenting anyways, because people don't know what we're doing. And of course, instead of looking at the problems that we have and looking at the issues that the web has and finding a solution in our intercommunication skills and our departmental skills, how companies are built, we just find technical solutions for it. My favorite is, of course, Adblock Plus. All of us probably have an ad blocker installed because we're clever. We're not the stupid people who pay money for the internet, right? We don't click on ads. That's just for the people who don't know about technology. The people that pay our wages. you know, the people that are basically we rely on to get money. And Adblock Plus cracks me up to no degree because it got bought by some company. We still don't know who. You know, could be the mafia, could be, like, even worse, the American government or Fox News. You know, could be anybody spying on you with a thing that makes you make the web better by replacing some ads. And then companies, of course, realize that as well, that publications like newspapers on the web are terrible. Because also, in the other way around, we don't want to pay for stuff online. We trained a whole generation of web users that everything is free. And if it's not free, you can do something half legal or illegal, but nobody cares, and you can get it for free anyways. Publication costs money, writing costs money, writers cost money, photographers cost money, all of these things, somewhere the money should come from. And all we did was put lots and lots and lots of ads on the web, and then we say, like, oh, it's the web is the problem. No, shit, lots of ads is the problem. So that's, how about we rethink about, like, how to pay for content online without having to pay too much, without paying once. And I don't want to have a subscription of a month to read one article in The Guardian. Well, I get it for free because I work with them. But I'd rather pay for, like, a micro payment for one article. Or I say, like, I have £50 a month for every newspaper website on this planet. So I can charge for this one, for that one, to read the different articles instead of just having to subscribe for each of them. These kind of models we're not thinking about yet because we're not thinking web. Web, to me, is a medium. It's the new radio, it's the new TV. It's not a software platform. If it were a software platform, everybody who publishes on the web would have to be a programmer, and that would be terrible. The idea of the web is that anybody who just can put some things together in a text maker or use what you see is what you get editor can become a publisher on the web. That's why it grew much faster than any other medium out there. That's why it's so wonderful. That's why that as an end user, I can translate content. As an end user, I can print content. As a blind user, I can navigate through content without asking for a second version of the thing. And that's what people still don't understand, that the web is this beautiful gift to publication and to communication in humans. It's as disruptive as the printing press was back then. But instead of fixing that, instead of saying, like, okay, we do terrible ads, how about we make the ads better? We make replacements. We've got instant articles on Facebook, for example, which pre-renders articles inside Facebook instead of using articles on the web. So instead of publishing in an HTML, which reaches people worldwide, independent of operating system, of software, of login, of everything, we now publish inside articles. Google accelerated mobile pages is slightly better. It's basically a mixture of RSS and WML, if you think about it. It's a subset of HTML that gets pre-cached and pre-rendered by Google for you. So that way you can make really, really snappy, fast websites just using the subset of HTML. And it's open source, so that's good as well. Then we got Apple News, which I have no idea about because I don't use iOS. I use OS X, but iOS I never got into. All of these things are open, but also kind of closed. You know, they're like, oh, yeah, look, the software is available, but if you want to publish, you have to use our CDN. If you want to be there, you have to have a Facebook login. And I'm like, this is not the web. The web doesn't have a login. That was the whole idea of it. I should not have to tell every single time the internet that I'm Chris before I can go somewhere. And governments very much agree with that, the English one very much so far. And we're not applying technology in a web-friendly format. We're just explaining it kind of skewed. We try to control the web continuously. And if there's anything that made the web grow, it's that it's a lack of control. And that's the beautiful thing. It's anathema for a lot of people to say, like, okay, my users can change the font size? No. I have this font size that our designers did that for the last 2 months. Like, we cannot allow people to change the font size. Favorite is when people do right-click protection so people can't download images. And you're like, look, I got a screenshot button. Oh, how do you stop that from happening? Don't give people computers. That's the way to stop piracy. Because there's always one way around it. And it's kind of skewed how we try to use the web right now to force people into closed environments. And this is what the whole work that I did with Firefox OS was about. That, like, I didn't need to have a $900 phone to go online, that I had a phone that was affordable for me to go online for the first time. And we just don't do that enough anymore right now. What does this code do? It's minified, so that's good. Any guesses? It's the follow me on GitHub button. And that's the kind of crap we put in our websites. This is the kind of like overload that we put in there. That's how we end up with 2.2 meg. Twitter is not a bad software company. Has a lot of my ex-colleagues from Yahoo went to Twitter, and they're really amazing engineers, but they had to make this work this way. And they gave you that code to put it inside your pages because it cannot fail. It had to work everywhere the same. It had to work differently everywhere. And connections are fast enough to swallow that. But I mean, this is a button. There's even a REST API. If you go to my blog, the follow Twitter button is basically just pointing to a REST API. It's a link. No JavaScript, nothing in there. No images, nothing there. But we want to control everything. We want to control the interface. It should be gray. It should tell if you can follow that person or if they blocked you and these kind of things. We do all kind of lookups, and that's how we ended up with that much code in that page. This is the nasa.gov website. And when you look at that one, after 1.2 seconds, you get an incredible preview of what space looks like. Vast and dark and empty. And then after 10 seconds, you start seeing content and the first spinner telling you that content will come. And after 17 seconds, you got the website. And again, these are not bad developers. Something went wrong in communication there. Somebody put things in there that are blocking. And what they did is they have 3 megabytes of blocking JavaScript before the first word appears on the page. They put Ember and Java and jQuery into one file, put it in the head of the document without a defer header, and before that, nothing loads. And that's just like, what? That's so simple to fix. That's so simple to realize. But as we are on fast connections, we have no empathy for that. We don't understand it. So what the hell happened there? Whose fault is this, and who can we set the hounds on? It's pretty much ours. Because said before, people don't understand what we're doing. But instead of teaching them, instead of standing up for ourselves and saying like, I'm not going to release this because, or this is not going to work because, we're just like, yeah, okay, I do it and put another library in there and make it work. And yeah, band's playing tonight, don't care. Web development is still governed by looks alone. Instead of people coming up to us and saying like, here's the content of the website, please write some semantic HTML around that and 10 lines of CSS to make them look perfectly, we get like 12 PowerPoints or PSD files and now turn this into something. Or even better, like, oh yeah, start with Bootstrap, change the colors, put another hero image in there, yay, website. Clients still expect websites to work the same on every browser and platform, and that is the biggest abuse of the web out there. If your product looks the same and works the same on every form factor, you released something terrible. You either went for the lowest common denominator and you're disappointing everybody, or you built something that is just so full of fixes and maintainability nightmares that your developers are not happy people and will leave very, very quickly. And the idea of like that a mobile phone gets the same as a desktop doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, look at what that thing can do, look at what that thing can do, and give it the right environment. And the technologies that we have are clever enough for this. We have if statements. We can ask the thing, can you display that? Okay, then I'm giving you that content. If you don't have enough space on that screen, why is that content even in that document? Nobody can reach that thing. It should not be ballast coming down the line. Quick delivery trumps quality and release processes. Like, oh, it's got to get out. Gotta get out, no time anymore. So that's why as developers, you should be in those meetings where time frames are set. And say like, we're gonna release this. And if somebody asks you for a time estimate, always put 2 days on top of it. Hope there's no project managers hearing that. Like, but always pad it, because you will need that time to fix things with. And I think it's very important that as an engineer, you have to start thinking about your career in the future as well. When I moved from like a lead developer to architect and then into evangelism and then into product management where I'm now, because it's just an official title, people are like, oh, you're not coding anymore then. I'm like, no, I'm sitting in the meetings where bollocks is made that you have to code. I stop people from making you do things you don't want to have. And this is something you should think about as well, because you're not getting younger, and you might want to be in a position where you can call the shots rather than just being the person who has to fix things that your higher-ups gave you sooner or later. We're asked to make things work and fix them later, but there is never a later, and I had that already. I think a lot of innovation, easy-to-use solutions feel to me like pure escapism. we always build these things like, you know, if our managers weren't these kind of blocking people, this is how wonderful the web would be. You know, this is, I can use this library to fix everything across browsers, and browser makers are terrible because I can do that better. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be any innovation. PPK from the Netherlands just announced half a year ago that browsers should not innovate for a year and just fix all the broken things out there. It's a nice idea, but it's not really practical because we have to come up with new things. And there's some amazing new things happening right now on the web, like progressive applications, service worker, all the cool things that we wanted to have that we have in native environments that the web could benefit from as well. But I think not everybody has to be part of it. You don't have to invent the bleeding edge of the web. The bleeding edge of the web is like this wide. There's not space for many people. And there's a lot of like broken technology there, a lot of things. It's called a bleeding edge because you bleed. So probably it's not for everybody, but you can help the web instead and make things more accessible. So you should concentrate on keeping the web a solid foundation, because we're right now losing that. We're innovating the web away from itself rather than just using the web. I love that, you got the wheelchair foundation with lots of stairs in front of it. We get high on technical solutions and get increasingly complex. There's blog posts, state of front-end tooling in 2015, explaining to you just how many things you need to know before you write your first line of code to build websites with. Like, just go to the terminal, buy a MacBook Pro, learn Unix before you learn CSS, these kind of things. It just drives me crazy that we take power tools that are there for power users and we throw them in the face of people who are just starting in that market, and then they get frustrated and go to native environments instead because they got an SDK where you click three buttons and you got your app. So why should I learn all that stuff? We make it far too complex for ourselves for good reason. For inside products, it makes total sense to have some of these things. And inside your company, you have a certain way of working. But that doesn't mean you have to publish it on the web and say everybody should use that as well. It's great talks, gets you keynotes and things at conferences. But when people can't take that to their company and copy it there, again, who did you serve with this rather than just yourself? So this is not an old man of the web ranting. Well, not exclusively. I mean, people always pay me for ranting. It's quite interesting. I worked exclusively fixing one massive issue of the web lately, and that is killing Internet Explorer. That's why I came to Microsoft, and that's why I said that in my interview. Like, I'm here to make sure we have a good browser and get rid of Internet Explorer, because all the innovation that I talked to people about, all the cool APIs, we had in HTML5, I showed them like the ambient light sensor, motion sensors, all the cool things we did in HTML5. The answer was always like, but I got to support Internet Explorer. And you're like, okay, let's get rid of that one then. And that's what we did. Like, Windows 10 comes with Microsoft Edge, which is an evergreen browser that does all the things you expect from a browser to do. It's very compatible with all the other browsers, and it's the browser you don't have to think about. That sounds like sales pitch, but when I worked with the team, I looked at all the stuff that the hoops that they jumped through to make the browser not break the web is stunning. I have a few talks about this where you can see that we had to put WebKit prefixes into our pages, into our browser, that we had to simulate the way Chrome renders something wrongly or different from the standard and follow the standard at the same time. We wanted to make sure that interoperability is the main thing. That's why we removed all the cruft that we didn't need any longer. You know, like all the things that were only in Internet Explorer and that since 1997 nobody with a right mind should have used any longer. Like VML, like SVG for Tesco SVG, really. Attach event, which is like add event listener, doesn't work the same way. Current style, layout quirks, VB script, conditional comments, prefixed events, all that stuff is gone. And it's in the browser that is already there. So Internet Explorer 11 is still on the machine because the web is very, very broken. And we cannot just tell people, okay, now the browser, upgrade your browser or else. A lot of stuff that is needs Internet Explorer specific stuff needs to run in IE11. IE11 doesn't get any updates anymore except for security patches, but it is on Windows 10 as a hidden app, so never show people it's there. They only the ones that have websites that need it will be told by Edge, okay, open it in IE because I cannot do anything with that. It basically is a bit self-serving because otherwise I couldn't book any travel or I couldn't book any expenses because all our internal systems are still running on IE11. So, mm-hmm. We're working on that one as well. So we have the old browser in there because we can't break the web overnight, but that was the main thing what we did with Edge. We put the browser out on the web, and then we made it look like it's Safari, and we made it look like it's Chrome, and rendered all the pages, and found all the bugs, and fixed all of them in there. So in essence, the engine is a fast, clean, new engine, where we took like millions of thousands of lines of code out, then we had to put thousands of lines of code in not to break the web, because people relied on broken and experimental technologies in other browsers. And this is what that looked like. We went to a website of an airline, I'm not gonna say the name, but this is what it looked like on Safari, on iOS, as we expected the future to be about 4 years ago. On Firefox, it looked like, okay, try to scroll around and find some information, and on Internet Explorer 11, it basically told you, I hate you, and please don't ever give us any money. Because that is not usable on a mobile phone. By the time you try to zoom into that, you probably booked 3 flights that you didn't want to touch, because tiny and whatever. And the problem with that was user agent sniffing. Instead of just testing for capabilities of the browser, which all of them had the same capabilities, people just said, like, if it's Safari, do this. If it's a browser I don't know, give you the I hate you 1997 experience. And we found interesting bugs there. WebKit appearance none is that you can override styling of form fields, so you can start styling them. So we had this dating site where on Safari your gender was either male or female, and in all other browsers it was an empty or a full radio button. They didn't even have male or female under it, so they basically just like, well, it's got to be experimental dating, I guess. WebKit gradient, you got gradient backgrounds that didn't show up. In this case, not that problematic, but we had websites that would have white buttons with white text because it's only a WebKit gradient, so we had to support these things. And educating is a kind of a tough job. We have this site scanner here that you can test up there. It shows you all the things that you're doing in your website that rely on certain browsers and rely on certain bugs. So this is a great way to go and clean out your websites and look at them. The biggest culprits we found there was aggressive browser sniffing independent of version number. If you do browser sniffing to fix a bug, put the operating system and the version number in there as well, because then we can fix it in the others. And it's only going to be that bug in that one browser and not in all browsers to come. Outdated libraries and polyfills, people don't upgrade their jQuery, people don't upgrade their like MooTools and these kind of things. And some of them actually meant we couldn't put new features into ES6 because we had these methods in these old libraries. So we had to rename the standard library, the standard methods. Lack of packaging and dependency loadings, dozens of JavaScript files, there's no inlining possible, so we couldn't make it faster. And if it works on Safari OS, that's what matters, no matter what the specification says. So a lot of times, we had to put things in there the way Safari rendered it, no matter if it was against the specification or not. We removed 200,000 lines of code, we put 300,000 lines in there, and 4,200 interop fixes, as I said before. So this is what we spent the last 6 months on. We could have released the browser much, much earlier, but we wanted to make sure it doesn't break the web by putting all these things in that other browsers did wrong as well. So we have a working communication channels between browser makers and developers nowadays, so we can talk to each other instead of just fixing things for each other. And as I said, we should have a symbiosis between developers and browser makers. Let's use them properly. Here's what I learned from working with browser creators. It's a constant race not to break the web. Every mistake web developers make needs to get catered for, because we cannot email you and say, like, fix that because it's broken in our browser, because you're like, your browser's wrong. You know, instead, when you make a mistake, we have to put something in the browser to not make it a mistake. The pressure is immense. People get very excited about comparing browsers with each other, like, Chrome has this, why don't you have it? Because it's experimental, it only works with their cloud, it only works on their machines, so why should we put it in there? It's not a standard of the web. When implementing standards, we find a lot of problems and feed them back. That's why a score of 100% in feature tests make no sense. Like when you go to ES6 feature tests or HTML5test.com, 100% can never be reached, because by the time we implement them, we found that the standard made mistakes as well. It's also by humans, most of them. Some people are W3C, I'm not quite sure. Most speed increases are based on analyzing and fixing developer mistakes and sloppiness. One of the things we made, for example, in the Chakra JavaScript engine, which we just released or announced open source, we're going to release it in January. I've got access to it. is for loops, for example. In for loops, people read the length iterator of the length property of an array on every little loop iteration, which made it slow. So now, before we actually run and turn a for loop into bytecode, we analyze what's in the loop and then realize, oh, that length iterator only needs to be read once. So that way, we made the JavaScript engine much, much faster because developers did the wrong thing, which is kind of weird, but interesting to see that this is the kind of effort that browser makers do for you. So here's my plea to help with better solutions for everybody. Stop telling people on the web that there are dozens of solutions that magically fix all their issues. You know, like, oh my God, I have this problem. And the answer is always like, use jQuery. Or like, use Bootstrap. Oh, that's not a problem. PostCSS can fix that for you. And you're like, no, it's a mistake. Tell them what's wrong in the browser, how to fix it. Or like, tell them this is in this version of IE, of Edge. Next week it's going to get fixed. Don't worry about it. Don't put code in there for the rest of the life. Stop catering to old browsers. Give them basic working solutions and enhance using feature detection. It's as simple as saying, like, if Navigator local storage, then use local storage. Don't, oh, if Navigator local storage, oh, use this library instead. This browser doesn't need that anymore. Internet Explorer 6 is a browser that is not available any longer. It's retired. It's in the park. It's feeding the ducks. It's playing football with other browsers. Don't give it any new things. Don't give beautiful interfaces to Internet Explorer 6 users. You just confuse them. They're expecting things to be horrible and be like five clicks and reload all the time. Don't try to do that. Explain, don't make it faster and easier. Explain why something is broken and explain how to fix it. Not like, oh, here's my solution, don't worry about it, it's magical because I'm an amazing developer. You're too stupid to understand it anyway, so just use that stuff. We're not teaching ourselves that way, and we're not bringing the next generation up of developers that know what they're doing. Show the dangers of quick solutions. I love that escalator just goes into the ceiling. So, like, yeah, it's faster, but boom. Keep things accessible for everybody. There is no technical baseline. It's always the arrogance of people saying, like, if you don't know ES6, you shouldn't be a JavaScript developer. Yes, you should be. Could be the mom at home, but the single mom making a website, making some extra money with that. You don't need to have a computer science degree to be a web developer. I don't have one. I'm confused by a lot of the words that people throw around. I just been there at the right time, right place. I was okay to move to another country, and I was open to change my environment all the time as well. I can code in like 12 different editors. I'm very, very efficient in one of them, but I don't need that environment to start developing. That's what you should be thinking about. Simply because you can fix anything with JavaScript does not mean you should. It's not the duct tape of the web, but we use it that way. So let's calm down. Let's get a bit more relaxed about the whole thing, because just because the tech press is looking at us as the only market that is hiring people at the moment and the only market that shows some growth, we don't have to get very competitive and we don't have to get very excited and worried about falling behind. It's just the way it is. The web moved forward the whole time. It's an evolving medium. It's not a software platform. What you're going to do in 2 years' time is going to be completely different to what you do now. But if you base it on standards and you base it on cross-browser and cross-platform thinking, then you don't have a problem with new platforms coming out. If you spend 90% of your time fixing things in environments and trying to control them, you're not open for new technology, you're not open for new form factors. We're not in a healthy state right now as a community. We build things to impress each other. The people who need our solutions never see them. So the end users out there, and I work with banks, I work with insurance companies, these people don't use those cool build scripts and libraries that we think is the standard for everybody already. We feel rushed and not good enough all the time. I read the JavaScript news in the morning and I'm like, oh my God, I'm falling behind. I have no idea what this person is talking about. I might be old, I have to go into duck farming or something like that, and like reindeers or whatever. We feel innovation is going too slow whilst not recognizing when something got fixed. We wanted oh so much when it was the thing to demand. The amount of stuff that is available in browsers now, custom events, form elements, promises, all the cool stuff that is in browsers nowadays that we like, oh, if only browsers had that, I could write much better code. We complained when it wasn't there, and now that it is there, we're not using it. So take a look at websites that tell you what's going on. So the first step to happiness is to make it happen. You can control your own destiny in terms of happiness. And the way to do it is improve your basic skills. check what is out there and don't just rely on a library to fix it. You will probably find that 90% of the libraries that you're using out of convenience, not of necessity. Browsers don't have to have these extra fixes any longer because browsers do these things for you. CanIUse.com is a great website to go every week and find out what browsers are doing right now and what features are available in browsers. Start helping people who are not at events and don't follow the Hacker News. By teaching people outside of our comfort zone, like even product managers, even program managers and things like that, and show them something cool that we're doing right now, you end up learning. When I wrote my first JavaScript book, I already had used JavaScript professionally for 5 years. And I realized I had no idea what I was doing. Because when I had to explain what JavaScript does under the hood, how the language itself works, what effect it has on browsers, then I started to understand what I'm doing. So it's totally fine to release something, but spend your extra time not arguing on Hacker News what is the coolest browser, but teaching yourself something new that you haven't thought before. Report problems, demand support for basic features, not only for the hot, half-baked ones. And reach out beyond your echo chamber. If you want to reach people who need the knowledge you have, so talk to end users, offer your clients some brown bags. Going to lunch for them, showing some cool new technologies that are not in use in their product right now, but would make their product better. That's how my career as a speaker started, because I offered that to companies in London. And that's all I had for the opening keynote, so thanks very much.
All right. Do we have any questions for Chris? You can see me miserably fail by drawing these capitals. Any questions at this point? Oh, there. Oh, you're so far away.
Whoa.
Man killed. Man kills person with microphone.
All right. Just a question or comment. You spend quite a lot of time complaining about different browsers not working, but do you not see that it's actually something that is really being fixed already? I think everybody else had fixed it, and now Microsoft has fixed it as well with Edge, that we don't have any browser versions anymore. We just have the browser, and it's always new. So this whole thing of supporting old IE, old Firefox, or whatever, it's basically a thing of the past. What, do you have any comments to that?
I want to see the color of the sky on your planet. Because it's... Yes, I would love this to be the case, but sadly enough, it is not. And that is what I was talking about. We're an echo chamber here. We're very excited about what we have, and we talk to each other about cool things that will come. But then you work with banks, then you work with insurance companies, then you try to buy a ticket online about any ticket website, including the big ones, and you just realize the web has not moved away yet. And the mere fact that we had to put 4,200 interoperability fixes into the browser just to make it work on the web right now means there is a lot of cleanup to be done. I very much agree that the attitude that you're having is like, sort it, browsers are evergreen, browser versions are gone, I work against the standard, and I test it in one browser, that's fine. Great, this is the attitude to have. But at the same time, we cannot expect everyone to have the same browsers that we have. A case in point is just Android. There's about 13 different versions of Chrome on Android, and there's even about 27 versions of WebKit on Android. So you're saying like, okay, they have Android, they have WebKit, they have Chrome, they have WebKit, means nothing. That's just a word. So a lot of what you have to do still is feature detection and capability detection before you actually put the things out there. And I think there is a wonderful experience right now when I was in Sydney last week and I talked to a big bank. And then after my talk, I get these emails from the product manager and the director saying like, whoa, I didn't know we had drag and drop uploads and we could zip files in the browser. We're putting this in our product now. And I'm like, yes, you know, when people can go to their online bank and out of a sudden that experience becomes better, that gets me more excitement than saying like, I built a JavaScript library to put the next feature of JavaScript into the browsers now. So we saved that, and with Edge we have it as well, but there's a lot of stuff to be fixed still out there. And I think it's very dangerous, and ironically, this is going to come in the next talk here. I think it's very dangerous to assume that we're all on the same level, because the next generation of users, and we're running out of users right now, because a lot of them are going to native environments, the next generation of users are going to be on awful hardware and awful browsers. So that does not mean that we have to not use the things that we want to use. It just means we have to think about what we're doing much more. So I'm saying like the war is won and we're done is wonderful, but sadly enough, I just moved Flash away from my computer completely, and it's amazing how broken the web still is. And I thought after 6 years of HTML5 and wonderful evergreen browsers, we would not have to do that. But people have like copy and pasting with Flash still, for example. You know, these kind of things. it's lurking all the time. I think it's we need to find a healthy middle ground between the like, oh, everything is evergreen and don't worry about it, and oh my God, everything is broken and Internet Explorer 8 is the thing I have to cater for. I don't look at the new stuff that you're doing. So we find a healthy middle ground between those is good. It's quite interesting when people ask me about why is Edge not available for OS X. And I was asking that as well when I joined the company. And then I realized just how much Edge is better on Windows 10 and how much it works with the other parts of the operating system. It would make no sense to put it on another operating system. We open source the JavaScript engine now. There's probably other bits and bobs of the browser that we will open source sooner or later. But why, as a developer, do I want to have all the browsers on my computer? That's old school thinking. That's exactly the thinking that you said should be over. I don't want to have 10 browsers to test in, because I don't test like an end user on my browser. I test like in my case, a Firefox user. And if I test Safari, I test Safari like a Firefox user. I don't use it the way Safari users use it. So having all these things to test it is just like, it's over. Just use a service for that if you really want to know if it works well on all the other browsers. It should not break. That's the most important thing to me. So when you say, I'm not attacking you here, when people say we all have evergreen browsers, we should be using all these technologies, yes, but use them in an if statement. Don't use them as an expectation, because that way you block other people out. And I think I'm going to come back to that one in the next presentation thingy as well.
Good. Did I answer your question? Yeah. Evangelized. Amazing. I'm going to take that one and then bring back to you.
Yeah, one of the things that this year has really been impressive is the HTTP2 adoption, which technically I think it was May when it was standardized, and now at the end of the year you can actually use it most of the places. What kind of experience did you have participating that or behind the scenes, because there were many large players, Google, Microsoft, Apple, all working on this together?
Well, it was basically a big happiness fest. We just went around a campfire and we shook hands and we drank a lot, and everybody was agreeing that everybody else does great stuff and we don't have to argue about things. No, it wasn't. HTTP2 is just a matter of like the web moving forward in terms of the networking stack, and it was very important. And I think the biggest thing what made HTTP2 happen was Speedy in between, that Google and Microsoft, Google and Mozilla came up with Speedy, which was an in-between standard, so to say, that taught the real standardization, the HTTP2, a lot. And it helped us also put a lot of features into the browsers and test them out before the specification was finished. So that way, that was very, very useful. And it was interesting because there's less argumentation on a networking level amongst browsers than on the feature level of of ES6, for example, or CSS. There's a lot of more stuff because we cannot control it. It's out of our hands. We need like router makers, back networks, like node providers, like all the people that built the internet, so to say, also to understand these specifications. So I think there's a great thing to be learned about this, that if you think as browser makers together about the internet rather than just your user interface, you can roll out things much, much faster. And HTTP2 is not only because of performance reasons a very important thing, but mostly about security. Anything that is not HTTPS should not be on the web to me any longer nowadays. It's just scary how many things you can inject, how much the government can spy on you. If you have data from your users that you don't store in HTTPS, it's actually a horrible thing to do to your end users, because you never know what gets injected in between. And you got fun things like, for example, Lizard Squad in Sweden, when they had a botnet running on routers rather than on machines. That was genius, because nobody checks their router software ever. If once you got a malware in there, that stays for the next 10 years. But with HTTPS, still that encryption would work as well. The only problem we have with HTTP2 and HTTPS is that end users might get confused about some things not working after a while. And the other thing about HTTP2 is that a lot of our performance best practices that we used in the last few years, like image spriting, minification, and putting lots of files together in one big one, is actually not good for HTTP2. HTTP2 has no problem with like 170 resources, HTTP has. So there's gonna be a lot of change in the performance world this year. But it was easier to roll out because we had an interim thing, and that's partly with ES6 as well. ES6 as a standard was faster to be implemented because we had things like TypeScript and CoffeeScript in between. So people use the idioms of the programming language before we put it into the engine. So that's where innovation really works, instead of just being innovation for that browser, I do this, for that browser, I do that.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the speech. And actually, this gets a little bit like back to the first question. Yeah, okay, we all know that the web is broken. And the problem is the word is out. And like, okay, nowadays, like we as like web developers are a little bit like worried that, okay, the customers will like always like turn to native applications because they are like portrayed as like easy and simple and so forth and so forth. Give us some weapons against that.
Yeah, so the question was, people go for apps because they work. They work for now, they're already dead. The app markets and the asking people to install an app for each and single one of them only makes sense if there's some really, really good thing. I mean, for example, most banks in England don't have any card readers anymore. They do two-factor authentication with an application on your mobile device, which makes sense. That's where an application makes total sense. Having a newspaper app that shows you a website inside a form, or having a website that sells bathrobes and like want to have an app, who's going to install that? Nobody. There's lots of good research into, and I have a lot of URLs that I can send out later, that how the app market is collapsing on itself. And I want to feel smug about this, and I do, because a year ago I gave a TED talk about this where I was ranting again, that I find apps a step back in software publication. Because when I started, we had to go online and you buy a CD and you get the CD sent to your house and then you installed it and you had your program. Nowadays, I want to have an app, I have to go on my mobile device, I have to have a mobile device, I have to log into it, I have to download 15 meg of application, try it out, hate it, delete it again. The web is a platform that actually gives you software on demand. So why do we go back to a software on consumption model? And the answer is that people want to control it. People want to control everything, that's why they want to have their app to have it there. But showing the people the numbers of who makes money with applications, it's Facebook and Google, and that's about it. Everybody else has to be damn lucky, or a games company that has about 2 or 3 months to release this one amazing game and make as much money as they can out of it, because it's a cutthroat competition market. And I find it depressing that we spend so much time making that understandable, and even more terrible when I look at things like in Africa, when you got like phones that have only Facebook on them and no internet. And you basically, people think like apps is things that I install inside Facebook, and Facebook is the internet. So we're having these silos still trying to fight the web out there. And I'm very excited about what Google is doing, for example, now with their progressive apps, that you could build a website for somebody and you make it performant and you make it responsive. And when you go to the first time to the website, you see it. When you go to the second time, the website starts putting things offline onto your device. The third time when you go there, it says like, hey, you're coming here every day. Do you want to have an icon on your homepage? And why not? We have the technology to turn the goodness of the web into offline functionality on your computer and make it look like an application, rather than having to package everything up as an application and then have to build it for every platform. Like you have to build it for iOS, which is the safe one, because people spend money on iOS. That's why most people release on iOS first. And then on Android, where you got the numbers of users, but nobody wants to spend money on Android. except for in-app payments. And then you got Windows Phone, which not that many people use, and Firefox OS, which not that many people use as well. But there might be a new platform coming. Tizen was supposed to be one. Web thing was supposed to be one. They're coming. So like writing in HTML5 and using packaging for different environments gives you both. So that's a good opportunity to do that. But not when your website is a massive thing with 10,000 ads on it and you just put it into a shell and wonder why nobody uses it on a mobile device. Because the mobile device should have a different interface than your desktop has. I'm not worried about apps. I actually am more worried about people who bet on apps as their only source of income. Because the web is going to survive this one as well. It survived other things like Flash.
All right, great. Any more questions? Yes.
Yeah, you were showing some slides about using ad blocker every time is more used. So I would like to know how you see the future of monetizing your content, because all the people is used to get everything for free, but of course the publishers are getting also tired of not getting any revenue back. So do you think that it's going to be more quality advertisement, what is going to be leading, or is going to be micropayments or a conjunction on everything? Because I guess that it doesn't make any sense to pay just for one newspaper when you want to read 4 or 5 at the same time. So I don't know, like, what's your insight in this topic about getting money from content?
Well, if I had a solution for that, I couldn't tell you, because I would be so rich, I would be on some beach. It is the biggest problem to crack right now. And I think there are some good things. The Financial Times just released an idea of having this, what I told before, that you have a monthly subscription for a set of newspapers, and then you basically pay for what you read rather than what you actually watch, much like anything like music distribution or film distribution with Netflix and Spotify kind of works as well. You subscribe to a lot of them rather than to only one of them. But I think it's, as much as I don't like how iOS limits a lot of technology, iOS 9 now having an ad blocker scares that market so much that they're actually having to think about something. That Apple News gave them a way out by just going siloing into Apple again is kind of depressing. But I think there is a concern in that market, and there has to be a concern, because the business model is 200 years old or something like that, and the web has changed around it. And I think the film industry is still learning it. The music industry already learned it. Like Spotify, I love the company to bits. I know the people. And Spotify, when they started, they said, we don't want to be a music service. We want to make music piracy unnecessary. And this is the attitude that I want to see people in advertising as well. I want you to like to pay for something because we give you some extra value and not continual growth and like massive amounts of things. It fascinates me that Facebook knows everything about me, but shows me ads that I don't care about at all. Like, where's the disconnect between the two? I mean, I could downvote apps that I don't want to have, ads that I don't want to see, but why not tell me, like, here's the 15 brands that I like. If there's a sales on that one in England, tell me about it and I'm gonna buy stuff. You know, like, we have to start thinking more about a symbiosis between advertiser and end user. And right now it's a fight, and the fight is being lost by both sides. And I don't have any solution for it, but subscription models to me make much more sense than just shoving advertising in people's faces. So when you build a new application, you build a new service, think about subscription up front. And people have done that, like pinboard.com and other things where like saying, okay, I don't want to show advertising in my app. I charge you $50 a month, take it or leave it. And they have less users, but they have a revenue stream. They don't have like the problem that they just have to massage numbers every month to show that some money comes in. They know where their money comes from and they can use it immediately. So being honest about yourself as a publisher on the web is something that a lot of people have to start understanding as well. And newspaper industry is dead anyways. Like, nobody pays for newspapers on paper. So they should embrace the web more and its benefits rather than just trying to fight it. But yeah, I don't have a solution for that. We had a few ideas in Mozilla that sadly enough didn't go to fruition. But next week when I'm in New York, I'm gonna meet with that team again, because they had some good ideas of allowing people to subscribe to ads rather than just getting shown ads to them. So you can cater for your own apps, ads, and realize that they're a necessary evil.
Okay,